this case is whether the stewards were entitled to rely on the plain language of the SCGE statutes when they made their election, or conversely, whether the department had the power to add economic substance and business purpose requirements that do not appear in the statute in order to disallow the steward's election over 1 year after it was made.
Mr. Berry, both parties seem to take the approach that the sale occurred when the transaction was closed. For purposes of this statute, why wouldn't the sale be deemed to have occurred when the binding agreement was entered into by the parties? Not a huge difference in time, but might make a huge difference in result.
Right. Well, and that's, Your Honor, that's because there were a number of conditions precedent to the closing of the sale. So there was an agreement that was entered into on February 26th, but if one of those conditions precedent had not been fulfilled, there would have been no closing. There would have been no sale.
So it's the existence of conditions precedent that, even though they were ultimately fulfilled and the transaction closed, that would dictate when tax law deems the sale to have occurred?
I think it's more than that. I think it's also the fact that at the closing, that's when the shares of the Stewart stock were actually transferred to Aurora Cooperative. And there's no dispute about that in the record. That wasn't an issue for the administrative agency or in the district court. So I think that that's established that the sale of the Stewart stock to Aurora Co-op took place on March 1st.
The other thing I'd like to ask you, and without taking too much of your argument time, is this court has used the step transactions in the past, the step transaction doctrine.
That's right.
In the past. What was our basis for doing that? Was it legitimate to do so?
I spent a lot of time looking at the Mid-City case and trying to understand exactly what was going on in that case. I think at a minimum we can say there are a number of differences between the case, between Mid-City and this case. So in Mid-City there was a conflict between two statutes, and it was really unclear how the legislature would have wanted these statutes to apply if the taxpayer made what's known as a Section 338 election under the Internal Revenue Code. What the court was really trying to do is use the step transaction doctrine to resolve that conflict. Now, that having been said, I've read the case several times that I don't understand how the step transaction doctrine actually applied in that case. There was not a multi-step transaction.
Let's assume for purposes of our argument today that the step transaction doctrine is a legitimate doctrine in Nebraska. Why would it not apply in this transaction?
Okay, a couple of different reasons, Your Honor. For one thing, it's important to look at the specific tax statute in question. So Mid-City Bank was a case where the tax statutes in question were revenue-raising statutes. Here we have a statute which is a tax incentive statute. It's creating a tax benefit. And the public policy reasons are different behind those statutes. Obviously, if it's a statute where the legislature is trying to raise revenue, that's one thing. But if it's a tax benefit statute that the legislature wants taxpayers to take advantage of, then taxpayers need to know how to take advantage of that benefit. And economic substance and business purpose requirements are amorphous. They cut against that certainty.
Do you have some authority behind this proposition of public policy?
Well, here's the authority I have. If you look at the cases that the department cites at the federal level, those are cases where a taxpayer was trying to create a loss, okay? They're trying to create a loss and the courts have looked at that in order to offset a gain, and the courts have looked at that and said, that's not legitimate. We just have something very different going on here in this case. And if you do look at the Horn versus Commissioner case that we cite in our brief, that's a federal case, and it's under the federal sham transaction and economic substance doctrines. And there the D.C. Circuit said, if Congress intended to authorize a benefit, regardless of its economic substance, then the sham transaction doctrine does not apply. And what we have in particular in this case is we have not just a tax incentive statute, but we have this one tax incentive statute, the special capital gains election, where the legislature hasn't added economic substance and business purpose requirements. We've got at least six others where it has. And so what this court said in Kerford, which I was about to get to, is that the intent of the legislature can be found not just in what the legislature puts in a statute, but what it omits from a statute. And the court in Kerford said, we presume that the legislature knows the subject matter on which it's legislating, and it knows the effect of the words that it's choosing. And in this case, the legislature does understand tax incentive statutes. This is a legislative decision. It understands economic substance and business purpose requirements. It's included those in six other statutes. It didn't do that here.
So this is in effect, in your view, it's an incentive if you do all the right steps. That's all it takes.
Right. They do all the right steps, and the legislature wanted taxpayers to take advantage of this incentive. If you go back and you look at the legislative history, there's a lot of things that can be uncertain in the legislative history. But one thing that is clear from the legislative history here, and that's that the purpose of the SCGE was to prevent taxpayers from leaving Nebraska and taking their investment capital.
So if you technically do all the right steps, regardless of their economic wisdom within each step, that
right.
should be sufficient for this statute.
Right. And if the legislature sets out the steps, then taxpayers, like the Stewarts, can do what the legislature requires. Now, maybe that the steps become so onerous that a taxpayer says, well, they're not worth it for me. I'll move to South Dakota. That's obviously what the legislature didn't want. It wants to make it something that taxpayers will take advantage of.
But what were the facts that made this corporation qualified for the special election to exclude from the federal adjusted income the capital gains from the sale of capital stock of the corporation?
There are a number of different things that were required to be met under the statute.
Well, there had to be at least five shareholders.
That's the key one here, Your Honor.
And two of those cannot be related to each other. Two of the shareholders or groups must not be related to each other.
That's correct.
Why is five important?
That's just the number the legislature picked.
But the next question is, each owns at least 10% of the capital stock. What evidence is there that the three new shareholders owned at least 10% of the capital stock?
Your Honor, the way that statute works doesn't apply to each of the five shareholders. It applies to the two groups that you just talked about. So there have to be two groups, each one of which owns at least 10% of the capital stock. And we had that here with the Stewarts as one group and Mr. Jensen as the other group.
Okay. But obviously the transfer of the stock to the three other people was less than 1%.
Right, right. But that's not an
issue. That's not required.
Right.
Okay.
Your Honor, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bartel, good morning to you.
Good morning. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Jay Bartel, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of Appalese, the Department of Revenue, and the Tax Commissioner. One of the requirements for claiming the special capital gains election is that the corporation have at least five shareholders at the time of the first sale or exchange for which the election is made. The District Court properly found the Stewarts did not satisfy five shareholder requirement because at the time they sold the Pioneer stock to Aurora, it did not have five shareholders.
What is the time of sale? I mean, you heard my questions with Mr. Berry about, is it closing date that's controlling, or is it the date of execution of the agreement?
The sale occurred on March 1st. Obviously,
all right.
That's when the closing occurred. The agreement, the separate stock purchase agreement, which we're contesting as being a sham and not having economic substance, was executed on February 26th. As along with the financing documents with it. I'm not entirely sure from the record, but I think there were stock certificates issued prior to the closing to the three individuals, Holweiler, Vincent, and Carlson. So I guess we've never really sat down and considered when did the actual sale of the stock occur. I see your point. If the sale didn't occur until then the five shareholder requirement may not have pre-existed the actual sale of Pioneer to Aurora. We have to go back and look at the record to see what exactly, when those certificates were transferred.
But nobody argued that.
No. I think the certificates were issued prior to sale.
And the sale was March 1st.
The sale March 1st, 2010.
The Stewart's sale.
The sale of Pioneer, all of Pioneer stock. It was treated as a sale of both those, the Stewart's stock, Jensen stock, and those three shares.
Okay, so what was the nature of the transaction between the Stewarts and the three additional shareholders?
The agreement, again, this was a purchase agreement between Pioneer and Aurora, specifically stated that there was an intent to structure the transaction so the Stewarts would qualify for the special capital gains election, and that there would be a transfer of one share of stock to three individuals who are also officers of Aurora 3 days prior to the closing in order to bring them to actually six shareholders.
So I guess from a tax standpoint, how is the state characterizing the nature of that portion of the transaction? Is that a sale of those single shares of stock, or is it a gift, or is it something else?
Well, as I understand the stock purchase agreement, that the purchase price was to be paid at or before the closing. So obviously the way it worked was that at the time of the closing, there was, I believe, there were three checks, $462, that were issued to these three individuals, and that was partial payment, and those checks were endorsed over to Mary Stewart. So for purposes of, so they did receive a check as if they were owners at that point. And subsequently in September, when the second installment was paid, it was another $1,606 that would have been paid to those three individuals, but it was simply paid directly to Mary Stewart.
That was because it was a loan set up for that transfer, is that correct?
Yes. So
it was like a seller financing.
Right, a non-recourse promissory note, right, was executed.
So it's your argument that that's the sham part of the transaction.
Yes. We say the sham part goes to the fact that obviously until there was an agreement for Pioneer to sell all their shares to Aurora. And so because they didn't meet the five shareholder requirement at the time they agreed to sell to Aurora, they put into that agreement this transaction we're challenging, and that is the addition of three new shareholders in order to reach the five shareholder minimum to take the election.
And what's important about five? Is that just an arbitrary number?
It's the number the legislature placed in the statute. And the reason we believe that the sham doctrine and economic substance doctrines can apply here, number one, is the court has already applied the transaction doctrine in the Mid-City Bank case. It recognized in that case that substance should control over form and tax matter. It recognized in that case that while the SEP transaction doctrine was originally applied in federal income tax cases, state courts have also applied that doctrine, and state courts have applied these common law doctrines like economic substance and sham transaction. So it's not a stretch for the court to do so in this case, and it would be consistent with what it did in Mid-City Bank. The problem with the transaction here is that there was no economic substance. There was no profit possibility because under the stock purchase agreement between Mary Stewart and the Holweiler, Vincent, and Carlson, the purchase price was basically the price of a share of stock that was agreed to under the Pioneer Aurora sale agreement, less $1. So obviously there's no profit potential. She would have realized more money had the sale gone through without that share being transferred earlier and being paid for as part of the sale to Aurora.
Is this case really about how much deference we should give to the Department of Revenue and their expertise in this area?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I think the key here is understanding the purpose of these anti-tax avoidance doctrines. It's not to contravene plain statutory language.
But is this an anti-tax avoidance doctrine, or is this a special capital gains election incentive? Was this created to entice people to keep their money in Nebraska?
It's a reward for individuals who have invested in companies in Nebraska. It gives them a benefit at the time they sell the stock.
And is that what happened in this case?
But it wasn't intended to benefit every company.
Just people with five shareholders.
Right, the five shareholder, you know, the 10% ownership, the unrelated shareholder requirements. And we don't believe the legislature intended to provide the benefit where you have a situation where you don't legitimately have a five shareholder corporation for any meaningful period of time that actually operates and exists as a bona fide
entity. The meaningful
entity.
Period of time, is where does that come from? The sham discussion?
Right, the notion that, in other words, that the sole purpose for the transaction is to qualify for the benefit. What those doctrines say is the statute really is intended to only apply to purposeful transactions. And here the legislature, we submit, did not intend for this kind of transaction to be used to reach the five shareholder level.
So if we were to say five shareholders for a meaningful period of time, how is that applied by the department? Well, how will that be applied by the department?
I don't want to say that there's a set time, but you have to look. In other words, if you didn't have five shareholders and it took place, whether it was a month, 2 months, 6 months, or a year, and you try to enter into a transaction to reach that, you have to look at the purpose for it. And again, if it's solely to obtain the incentive without there being any real economic substance or business purpose for the transaction, then these doctrines would still be in play. Now, what we have here are a unique set of facts that we think make it very obvious.
But obvious though it may be, I'm still back there about the rationale for importing the sham transaction economic substance universe of cases when the legislature has kind of made it simple, five at the sale.
Well, but the whole point of these doctrines is that even if you meet the literal language of the statute, that a transaction is disregarded because that isn't really what the true purpose of the statute was. And we're saying that the true purpose here was, yes, there's a five shareholder requirement, but the legislature had to contemplate that it would be a meaningful.
Well, if they wanted five shareholders that had a meaningful position with the corporation, why didn't they require all five shareholders to hold at least 10% of the stock? These minimal shareholders obviously don't have anything to do with it. They're just numbers.
Right, and given the time involved, they really could exercise no real ownership or rights of ownership as stockholders. That's another reason.
But the legislature didn't require that as far as being a qualified corporation for election of this exemption from capital gains.
Well, obviously there's the unrelated requirement and the 10% requirement and the five shareholder requirement. The history indicates they were all, I think, intended to try to curb abuse, and primarily the notion was closely held family corporations would not be able to use this. Well, it turns out that exactly what happened here is you had a situation where you could kind of create this advantage by making that kind of a sale at the end. But the legislature didn't intend, we believe, this kind of transaction to be made in order to qualify.
But the legislature could have put on some more requirements for a period of time and so forth.
Sure, they could have, but the point is that the purpose of the statute, we think, is not fulfilled if this kind of transaction is allowed, and that's exactly why you have the anti-tax avoidance doctrines, because the ultimate goal in statutory construction is to honor the legislative purpose. And if a literal application doesn't do that, then these doctrines are legitimate ways to do so.
On the face value, on March 1st, 2010, this sale would have met the requirements, face value. Without implying the sham transaction.
If you don't disregard those three shares, there would have been six shareholders, yes.
So it would have met the requirements. The meaningful time frame is arbitrary.
I don't want to say meaningful time frame. That was probably not the best way to phrase it. I think the corporation would have had a true existence as one that had been owned and operated under the five shareholder statutory structure, and rather than one where clearly that didn't happen. Time frame is really not the key.
So if we get this to the plain statutory reading, then the agreement is met.
If it matters not who, what, when, why, how they got to five, that's true.
But they look good on that day if those other features are ignored.
Right, but we don't think that it's appropriate to do so. That doesn't, not consistent with the legislature.
Mr. Bartel, Mr. Berry articulated a distinction between the type of tax statute involved, that is one imposing tax in the sham transaction doctrine in federal cases versus here where the tax statute grants a credit or an exemption. What's your view of that distinction?
I think part of that is the Stewart's cite to a number of what I call incentive legislation statutes that have language that says transactions without business purpose or do not increase economic activity won't create tax benefits credits or entitle persons to those. But those are in different statutes. They're LB 775, the Quality Jobs Act. All of those statutes are incentive legislation because you can't get the benefit unless you agree to create a certain number of new jobs or make a certain level of investment.
And those are on the front side.
And if you look at the history, yes.
But they could be clawed back.
They can. But the reason that business purpose language was put in was because there was a concern that because of the way those statutes work, someone could qualify for benefits, for example, by relocating a business or laying off employees and then hiring new employees and claiming they've met the new employment thresholds. We don't think the special capital gains election is like that. It's a benefit that's based upon ownership in a qualified corporation. It's a one-time election. It's not the same kind of incentive quid pro quo legislation that these other statutes are. So that is why there is no similar language.
What do you make of the absence of language in this statute that would, for lack of a better term, close this loophole?
Again, it's not there. I mean, there's no specific language that says it has to have economic substance, but the doctrines aren't dependent upon the literal language. Again, they are used because the literal language doesn't achieve the statutory purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has a minute 47.
A minute 47?
Yes.
Minute 47. You got at least 2 minutes, Mr. Berry.
Thank you, Your Honor. The absence of language in the statute, there's different ways that courts can look at this. Right? And Mr. Bartels has mentioned the way other state courts have looked at this. Now, some of the state courts that he's cited in his brief, their decisions, have situations where the legislature has said, we want the courts to follow federal tax law doctrine. So those cases are simple. I think the case that's most analogous here from another state is the HMN Financial case in Minnesota. If you look at that case, you'll see that the Minnesota Supreme Court says, we look at statutes in a way that is directly analogous to Kerfer. Their case is called Hutchins. But under that approach to statutes, we're not going to read something into a statute that the legislature didn't put there. And if the legislature authorizes a tax benefit, the plain language of the statute, it exists. And HMN involved a minimum shareholder requirement, a minimum requirement of 100 shareholders in a REIT. And there the court said, we can't see any business purpose other than to qualify for this. But because the legislature authorized it, the tax benefit.
We have the statute that imports federal tax statutes into Nebraska, state tax statutes, and would cover this particular section, correct?
We don't know. We don't have a statute like that that says, where the Nebraska legislature has said, we want the courts to follow the guidance of federal tax cases.
I'm saying we have a tax statute. A Nebraska statute says, for purposes of our act, the federal Internal Revenue Code of 1986 or whatever it is, those sections shall apply.
There are certain sections that have been incorporated. There are certain ways in which Nebraska law follows the federal tax law explicitly by legislature, and then there are other ways.
And my question, that was sort of the predicate to, when the legislature incorporated the federal tax statutes, did it also manifest an intent to incorporate court decisions interpreting those federal tax sections?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That takes us then to the next case of the day, which is Donut Holdings, Inc. versus Risberg. Justice Stacy is likewise recused in this matter. Mr. Barber.